Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance. Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Animal cruelty has been in the public eye this year. In February, more than 30 Persian cats were found in a Barnstead home in conditions described as deplorable. Then this month, about 80 Great Danes were rescued at a mansion in Wolfboro, living in unbelievable filth. And just last week, 4 horses were taken from a dairying farm, ill, neglected, and kept inside in a barn one observer called gross and sad. Now, all these cases so close together are raising a lot of questions about whether our state laws on breeding and animal cruelty should be tougher, about when neighbors and town officials should step in, and about the whole psychology of animal hoarding, a mindset where the people involved often love these creatures and believe they're doing the right thing. Today in The Exchange, we look at all this, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have 3 guests in studio. Lindsay Hamrick is here, State Director of the Humane Society of the U.S., along with Sarah Proctor, Director of the Veterinary Technology Program at UNH and a Clinical Assistant Professor at the Thompson School of Applied Science, and Lisa Dennison, Executive Director of the New Hampshire SPCA, based in Stratham. Welcome, all of you. And Lisa, I want to turn to you first. Boy, more than 30 cats, more than 80 dogs, then these horses, all living in terrible conditions, most of them quite ill because of those living conditions. What do you make of this string of events, Lisa?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting us here today. It's really an honor to be here and to be with our other guests here. So thank you. It's truly unfortunate that we're seeing so many cases so close together, but this is not new news. The New Hampshire SPCA was founded in 1872, and so for 147 years we've been looking specifically at issues of cruelty and neglect. So this goes on, you know, back hundreds of years when the industry really was first founded. I'm glad that more people are taking notice and taking responsibility to step forward and bring it into the public eye and bring it to the authorities, because that's the only way that we can stop it, and also through education to change the next generation and make those corrections. So, you know, the cases that you mentioned were just a few of the cases. There are more that have happened in the last 2 months that we could add to that.
Wow. So, and that relates to something that your organization, Lindsay, the Humane Society, has said, and I'm quoting here, the shocking number of animal cruelty cases reported every day is just the tip of the iceberg. Most cases are never reported. Can you just elaborate on that, please, Lindsay?
Absolutely. And thank you for having us here today. Such an important conversation. I think for us, because we work on a national basis, there's so many different types of animal cruelty situations that we see, everything from dogfighting to suspected puppy mills to hoarding cases. And what we really try to emphasize is exactly what Lisa just said, which is that we can't address these issues unless we know about them. And the more people who are educated around the laws that are in place and our expectations of how animals should be treated, it allows us to then get the tips and the information that we and law enforcement needs to be able to intervene, which is exactly what we experienced with this case in Wolfboro.
Well, and how do you, Sarah, define animal cruelty?
Well, there's a legal definition, and then there's everybody else's definition, and those aren't always the same. in legal terms, I think there's a difference between cruelty and neglect, and those cases are prosecuted differently. I think cruelty requires that there's an intention to hurt an animal, that you beat it or you kicked it. And neglect suggests that you are omitting to do something. You're not giving it food. You're not giving it shelter. And so legally, that's there's a difference there between cruelty and neglect. And I think what we're seeing in these recent news reports and what I've seen more of is neglect. I think it's I also work at the Kachika Valley Humane Society in Dover, and we don't see as many cases of volumes of animals being neglected, but we see lots and lots of animals that come in as an individual from one home that have been neglected and not cared for well. And I think that's something that people have been discussing is how difficult it is to prosecute somebody for neglect because of the way the laws are structured, and it doesn't rise to the level of cruelty in the legal sense. I think cruelty has a higher penalty.
Sure. And these cases that we've seen have been more about just people getting in over their heads, getting a lot of animals. All of a sudden, they can't take care of them. I wonder what you think, Lisa, about this, too, this sort of line that Sarah was talking about between animal cruelty, animal neglect, animal abuse.
Well, one of the challenges that we see is that, you know, it's a slippery slope. It can be that continuum. So you may start out with, you know, and we saw it just this week. We've had 34 rats surrendered to us. So innocently, two animals are adopted or purchased. I'm not really sure where they came from. They unfortunately were not the same sex. So next thing you know, there were 34 rats.
Wow.
So they were surrendered. We had the same thing with birds. Somebody adopts two birds. They adopted a third. We ended up taking 60 birds out of the home, out of a second bedroom of a house. It became a neglectful situation. It became a hoarding. It was a slippery slope. And so that is something that individuals need to see and others need to be able to react to. And when they see it, when somebody goes and visits a home and says, oh, my goodness, what's all the racket in your second bedroom? And say, oh, well, I have, you know, 10 or 15, 20 birds. And then you open the door and you recognize that there's 30, 40, 50, 60 birds taken out of a bedroom. That becomes a problem. But where it goes into cruelty is, again, with intention. But sometimes that intention is extreme neglect. You know, when we've taken a horse that had a rope around its leg to the point where it's severed the skin and become embedded, you know, that becomes problematic. That's almost becomes more than neglect because they're actually, you know, allowing this animal to suffer.
The exchange number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, understanding and preventing animal abuse and neglect, given several very high-profile cases in New Hampshire recently involving very poorly treated cats, dogs, and horses. And then one of our guests just told us about several new situations where someone clearly got in over their head in terms of owning animals. The exchange number for you to join us with your comments, questions, concerns is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I want to ask all of you about animal hoarding because it sounds like that's where we're going. And that was the situation in a couple of these cases that we've seen recently. We spoke yesterday with Agriculture Commissioner Lorraine Merrill, who says these cases of animal hoarding are sad for the animals, she said, and sad for the people.
With cases that really, such as the most recent one in Wolfboro, have all the hallmarks of animal hoarding, which really clearly has mental health or mental illness issues involved. People who do this, they think they're helping these animals. They often think that they're rescuing them, they're caring for them, and it's kind of delusional.
Again, that's Agriculture Commissioner Lorraine Merrill talking about the mental health aspects of animal hoarding. And Lindsay, I remember when the cats were rescued back in February, about 30 or more, the head of the Concord Pope Memorial SPCA said she'd received a lot of communication from the public with very harsh language about the man and his son involved in this. And she urged people to have compassion for them, quoted in the Concord Monitor as saying, in their own way, they were trying. They were clearly overwhelmed pet owners. What's your thought, Lindsay, on the psychology of people who hoard these animals?
I think that one of the things that we really strive for is to deal with these issues on a case-by-case basis. And I think I would caution us around generalizing a situation with multiple animals or many animals as always being conditions of hoarding. For example, and I certainly can't speak to the mental health condition of the defendant in the Wolfboro case, but I think for me, in all of my years of dealing with animal cruelty cases, a hoarding situation, typically the other characteristics of those situations are that they're collecting other kinds of things as well, so newspapers or other items. And these tend to be folks who started out with maybe just a handful of stray cats that they took in, didn't have the resources to spay and neuter. Those cats turn into 60 cats and they're at a loss. That feels to me very different than somebody who is breeding one particular breed of dog, selling them online for thousands of dollars. Certainly, we need to address these cruelty cases on a case-by-case basis in terms of intention or not. But I think we also need to have coalitions of social service workers and others to assist with looking at these cases in terms of whether there truly is this hoarding challenge versus somebody who has gone into a commercial operation and gotten out of hand.
Or versus somebody like Lisa mentioned, and Lisa, I'll ask you this, who, you know, adopted two rats, thought, you know, they were getting a single-sex pair, and it turns out it was a male and a female, or the birds. So there's people who get in over their heads, but have the mentality that they'll call you and they'll say, could you please take these rats or birds off my hands? I've gotten over my head and I feel badly about it. And the person who just keeps going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's really important that individual, you know, with those rats, they were surrendered to us. You know, they were not able to stay in that home. And that was fine. But people need to recognize and take those measures. And that is being responsible. And so we're grateful for that. We've certainly seen people who have hoarded, and those situations where you're going into a home and you can barely get through an aisle because of the collection of items in their house in addition to the animals that are now running at large and have been breeding out of control or whatever the case may be.
Well, Tufts University has a whole group of researchers who look at animal hoarding. They've got a whole, you know, organization there. These researchers say hoarding is a community problem. In addition to being cruel to animals, it can, they say, be associated with elder abuse, child abuse, self-harm. Sarah, how do you teach your veterinary students about hoarding? What do you tell them? And what role can vets play in identifying this problem?
The consortium that you mentioned, the Hoarding of Animals Research Consortium, they're a group of people that have done probably more work than anybody that I've seen on this topic. There's not that much information out there. what I try to teach my students about hoarding is we focus a lot on the animal side of it. How are you going to help the animals once
right,
cause you
get them out? Right,
because you're a
veterinary school, right.
The people in the consortium have made this little guidelines for us to try to separate people who are hoarders into different categories. And they've established some vague ideas about how you can intervene with different kinds of hoarders. The first type of hoarder is the overwhelmed caregiver who, like Lisa's case of the rats, they didn't intend to do this. It just kind of happened. Or maybe they have 10 cats and they lose their job and they've been taking care of 10 cats easily, but now they don't have money. And so they become overwhelmed, and characteristics of those people tend to be that they're more willing to receive help if it's offered.
The overwhelmed person who,
right,
again, had 10 cats, was doing fine, and then lost
right.
his or her job, and all of a sudden it's too expensive.
Yep. The next category of hoarder is the rescue hoarder, who maybe has more mental health issues. That kind of person has more of an issue with bonding to the animal, maybe in an unhealthy way. They see themselves as the only hope for the animal. They have trouble giving up on a sick animal, and they have very much trouble with death. And then the third category of hoarder is the exploiter hoarder, who maybe has more malicious intent, that they're doing this for some kind of benefit to themselves. And those people are probably the hardest to intervene with, because they're going to fight you harder than maybe some of the others. So I don't think these are distinct categories. These are just sort of guidelines that they've put together to help us decide how to approach an individual based on what we know about them, knowing that the overwhelmed caregiver may be easier to approach and easier to intervene with, and the exploiter is going to be much harder, and then the rescue hoarder is somewhere in between.
Has an idea that he or she is helping,
right,
by taking these animals in.
But there is a lot of discussion about the mental health aspect of it, and which type of hoarder has a mental disorder. You know, the animals that are living in homes where there's lots of object clutter and maybe
hoarding other things.
Right.
Yeah. Lindsay, did you want to jump in as well?
Yeah, I also wanted to reiterate the importance of that this isn't a community issue, and that it involves so many different players when it's done correctly. And last year, the Humane Society of the United States partnered with DCYF and with Child and Family Services to do a training around the state for child protection staff to try to identify animal cruelty throughout the course of their work. And there was such wonderful feedback from that in terms of giving them the skills to identify. And of course, when we go into homes, we're absolutely looking for if there's impacts to children. Hoarders have almost 100% recidivism rate in repeating their behavior. So if we don't work together as a coalition to try to address whatever the mental health challenge is that's there and other factors, we as animal professionals will need to continue to go into those homes year in and year out and pull animals, and that's not what we want to see happen.
Wow. So unless you help the person who has the mental health issue where they think that this is okay and maybe even beneficial, you can clear all the dogs and cats out, but next year or the year after, you're going to see the same thing.
Exactly.
So you have to deal with that challenge. Go ahead, Sarah. Yeah.
And I don't think there is that much knowledge in the mental health community in how to address somebody that is an animal hoarder. I think it's sort of been classified as a type of hoarding, but I don't think there's that much information about how do you intervene with a person like that, especially if we're saying you can't have an animal as part of maybe your court proceedings. It's not safe for the animals for you to have one, but if you have a very close attachment to the animal and that's part of what keeps you going, is that person going to be amenable to any kind of mental health assistance if they can't have the animal that is helping them get through their day?
Well, sure. And it's interesting talking to the three of you. You are all animal professionals, but clearly there's an element of needing a deeper understanding, it sounds like, and more research and more help around the human psychological aspects of this. Yeah, Lisa, real quick.
I would say absolutely. I wanted to reiterate what Lindsay was saying in terms of the collaboration with social services. And that's an area I think that is an industry that we can continue to develop. We've talked about that over the years, that correlation in domestic violence as well as in hoarding with social services. And as Sarah was mentioning a moment ago, the individual who's hoarded, we've prosecuted cases where then we've determined or discovered that the individual has actually relocated to another state and is again collecting and hoarding animals, and trying to get those laws or that person to actually be convicted and serve time so that that stops or get the services they need.
Wow. Okay. Well, after a short break, we'll dig into more around what the laws concerning animal hoarding, animal abuse and neglect say here in the Granite State, and we'll start hearing from you. So join us 1-800-892-6477.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses.
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, understanding and preventing animal abuse. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at this topic given several very high-profile cases in New Hampshire recently involving extremely poorly treated cats, dogs, and horses. We're looking at how these extreme situations develop, what our laws say, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And all of you, here's an email from Kevin that came in who says, don't let the woman in Wolfboro off so easily by saying she was a hoarder. She was a seller of purebred dogs in a $1 million house. This was intentional, Kevin says. And Kevin, thank you for the email. And Lindsay, let's just remind people, first of all, what this situation was in case they didn't hear about it.
Sure. So the Wolfboro Police Department, acting on citizen concerns that came in to both them and to the Pope Memorial SPCA in Concord, built a case around the situation in Wolfboro. And we came in because when we realized the sheer size and number of dogs who were likely in that house, there wasn't an individual animal shelter or even collectively who could absorb those animals. So
that's a lot of dogs all at once.
It is a lot of dogs. And it took us 4 horse trailers to get all of the dogs off scene. So logistically, it was a huge challenge. And
20 hours or so.
And about 20
years.
I'm surprised it'd take longer, yeah.
So the Humane Society of the United States was asked to come in and handle both the rescue and then to provide the long-term care for the animals in an emergency shelter until the case reaches its conclusion. Essentially, we're holding the town of Wolfboro's evidence in a criminal investigation, for lack of a better term. And what we found when we went in was just absolutely horrendous conditions for animals and for people to live in. Animal waste all over the place. The dogs had no access to water. And so it was very clear that the evidence that had been collected prior to the rescue was confirmed when we went in. And so all of those animals were seized that day. They're now evidence in the criminal investigation and waiting for the outcome of this case in order to decide what their fate will be, essentially, whether they will be relinquished and be allowed to go into loving homes or whether or not they will go back to the defendant. And that decision is left up to the courts.
Really? So there's a possibility that these animals, even given the extreme conditions that they were forced to live in, might go back to the owner?
Correct. So in cruelty investigations, animals are really a unique piece to our criminal justice system. They, unlike other forms of evidence, we can't store them in a locker for 9 months and give them back to the defendant if that's the decision of the court. So we hold them the same that we hold other kinds of evidence, but obviously they require very heavy-duty care every single day. So it will ultimately be the decision of the courts as to whether or not she's convicted and whether or not these animals have that outcome.
Okay, Kevin, thank you for the email. Sarah, did you want to jump in?
I was there with Lindsay, and I can confirm all that she said. I, as a veterinarian, I have seen cruelty and neglect in the hospital, in the shelter, where the animals have come to me. But I have never been involved in a seizure like this, and I feel like it was emotionally one of the hardest things I've ever done, walking through that building, seeing the home with the dogs in the home. It took me a long time to get over it, and I think the most the thing that you don't get from the news reports, the videos, the pictures, is the smell. Not just the smell of waste and feces, but the ammonia smell that you couldn't be in some of these rooms that had no ventilation. You couldn't be in the room for more than 20 seconds without your eyes tearing and your throat closing up because of the very, very high levels of ammonia. And these rooms were rooms with no ventilation. The dogs didn't look like they had ever been out of the room. That was what hit me the most.
Well, and you wonder how the dogs breathed, given how you had a hard time breathing. You know, this case, like so many others, came to light finally. The police got involved after, you know, neighbors had been sort of, you know, tipping people off and town clerks had some funny ideas that something funny was going on. After this came to light, though, a lot of people said, hey, what about the state? You know, why isn't the state doing more in terms of oversight? Again, we spoke with Agriculture Commissioner Lorraine Merrill. She says her department does not have primary responsibility for these cases of suspected animal abuse and neglect. Let's hear.
These issues are really do come down more to a local level. You have between local zoning regulations and the animal cruelty and neglect regulations fall under the criminal code under law enforcement. So local police force, local animal control officers, local health officers may all have a role.
So Lisa Dennison, I'd love your thoughts too on sort of who's responsible for reporting these cases.
Well, I'd like to address an issue that the state may or may not legally have the responsibility, but the challenge is with every town is required to have an animal control officer, or what happens in the towns that don't have animal control is that every police officer becomes an animal control officer, and not everybody has the training. But the other thing that happens that we found over the years is that towns are very reluctant to take on animal cruelty cases because of the costs involved. So thankfully, HSUS was able to step up in this case because, as Lindsay said, there's no agency or even collection of agencies that
could
handle.
That's the Humane Society, yeah.
Correct. But in other cases that we've been involved in where we've removed 125 animals, for Berlin, for example, when we actually submitted the bill, it would have shut the police department down. In Newton, when we did the DeVito case and took all the fighting pit bulls, it would have shut. They only had two officers. So when you send them a bill for, you know, $30,000, $50,000, whatever the case may be, because though animals are supposed to be expedited cases because it's live evidence, the reality is that it isn't. And so the cases will be in court for 6 months, a year, 14 months, 16 months, we've had cases. And so the bill accumulates not only the immediate medical care, but then the boarding care for these animals. And if you have a hoarding case and you've got 33 dogs or 19, you know, whatever that number of animals is, it's a multiplier. And so the bills become exorbitant. And at one point, the New Hampshire SPCA, I happened to bring our accounts receivable statement for restitution. We had over $116,000 on our books in court-ordered restitution. But the challenge is that the individual didn't have the funds in the first place, maybe not perhaps in a professional breeding and selling situation, but in a more
many typical
hoarding cases, etc.
People are over their heads or they don't understand.
Exactly. They don't have the resources in the first place. So when they have a $33,000 bill because the animals were not surrendered, we went through the court, they have all the legal bills as well, they aren't able to pay it. And so then it may go to probation. But probation has told me repeatedly, we're not bill collectors when individuals don't. So it's a very frustrating situation.
Wow. And a lot of costs incurred,
I can see.
You know, again, with the cats in Barnstead, that's 30-some-odd cats who had all sorts of medical problems, dental problems, respiratory problems, and then the dogs. I mean, it's staggering. 80 dogs who are kept in these deplorable conditions. Who pays for those animals' return to health and their boarding while these court cases proceed? Go ahead, Lindsay.
Yeah, I think I want to make two points on this. The first, in terms of the state's involvement, while the Department of Agriculture does not have jurisdiction over cruelty, they are a resource to local law enforcement in cases. And secondary to that, in terms of the Wolfboro situation, the Department of Agriculture is the agency that regulates commercial breeders in this state. And so there needs to be, and they regulate pet stores and shelters and rescues as well. And so there is a state responsibility to regulate what's happening with animals, at least in the ones that are being sold or adopted out. And we believe very strongly that that regulation is so key. And with that regulation, a requirement for mandatory unannounced inspections of all of those facilities. This woman lived on the end of a dirt road behind a gate. There's no way that consumers would have ever known how these animals were being raised. We need some oversight from the state to know that someone is going in those situations regularly.
So what is the oversight from the state? Lindsay or Sarah, if you want to jump in, what is the oversight from the state right now? What does the law say the state has to do in terms of overseeing breeders and people who sell animals?
So the law currently says the Department of Agriculture regulates anyone in the business of transferring animals. So it's a fairly vague definition. Commercial breeders are defined as people who sell 50, that's 50, puppies or 10 litters of puppies in 1 year. Our commercial
50 is a lot.
It is a lot, and our commercial breeder law is one of the weakest in the Northeast. Vermont's bar is 3 litters a year, and in Maine, which is an even better version, they dictate commercial breeders as anyone who has 5 breeding females in their facility or more.
So, and 50. So, in the Wolfboro situation, Lindsay, that would not have risen to the inspection status. Because my understanding is the woman wasn't selling very many puppies. She just had a whole mess of dogs.
Well, I don't know. As we look into this situation further, we will find out whether or not she reached that bar. The problem with the current law is that in order to find out how many puppies somebody's selling, you have to track down health certificates, because by law, every animal needs to have a health certificate. So that requires a lot of resources on the Department of Agriculture's perspective to track down paperwork. We would rather see a law where the number of breeding females is the bar, because then somebody walks into a house or a facility and can count unspayed females who are used for breeding, which is a much easier regulation to enforce.
Go ahead, Sarah.
And that would put less of a burden on the department. I think that's a big issue that they have, is that it's a staff of one veterinarian and a couple of technicians who are supposed to be overseeing these breeding operations, also in charge of keeping the food supply safe and monitoring farm animal diseases. And I know that they struggle to get their job done. And if we had some type of stronger laws that required more inspections or you know, they'd need to have more funding so that they could do the job that has been put to them, because right now they struggle to do that.
So it's not reasonable to ask for that because of staffing concerns? Sarah?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think they're struggling to do the work that has been put to them at this point.
Lisa?
They certainly, though, could look at appointing others, because that is within the law, saying it shall be inspected by an employee of the department or by a person appointed by the department. So there are certainly humane officers throughout the state that could be utilized in this manner through the various humane societies or other people that are appointed, whether it's a veterinarian or some other resource.
So you could deputize other people?
Absolutely. It's really a critical factor to be able to do these inspections. Without these inspections, this case could have gone, or not this case because it wasn't inspected, but other cases that we've seen of breeders could go on for years without anyone ever noticing.
Well, let's hear again from Commissioner Merrill on this, saying she's not sure that these one-time annual inspections guaranteed that breeders were taking good care of animals. Commissioner Merrill says, you know, personal observation is also important by those of us looking to adopt a dog or a cat.
Everybody who visits a pet shop or shelter looking to possibly adopt, et cetera, is conducting that sort of an inspection and their own observations. And they can always contact us, the Department of Agriculture, if they have concerns or even questions.
All right. Again, that's Agriculture Commissioner Lorraine Merrill. And today on The Exchange, we are looking at understanding and preventing animal abuse, how and why these extreme situations develop. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, again, is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Keene, where Denise is on the line. Hi, Denise. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to share sort of a funny story, but it goes to the point of judgment in that I worked in animal welfare for 10 years. I've actually worked with Lindsay Hamrick for quite a long time. And years ago, my daughters and I adopted some gerbils from the Humane Society. We adopted three, and we had relied on my fellow coworkers to sex them. And within about a year, I had 34 gerbils because they started to breed. And before I could actually get them all separated, because they breed quite quickly after giving birth, I found myself with 34 gerbils by no fault of my own. And the point I want to make is to bring them in was very sort of challenging. I mean, I didn't have any other choice, and I worked there. And clearly the staff and us, you know, we all thought it was sort of funny. But as I walked in, I'll never forget that day, carrying this glass case with these rodents running around in it and people looking at me like
you were,
you know,
yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing. And it was very hard for me, and I worked in the industry because of the judgment that I felt. So I can't imagine how anybody else feels. And I'm not talking about the cruelty case and the neglect and all that. You sort of started the program with some 64 birds, and there were some rats and stuff. And I don't know all the particulars of that, but I do know there's a huge amount of judgment that falls on us as we bring them into.
Yeah. Well, Denise, thank you for calling. So it's kind of embarrassing, Lindsay. And I have read time and time again that people just don't want to admit that they're in over their heads. And that embarrassment that Denise talks about is probably part of it.
Absolutely. And I think one thing that's really important to remember is that the animal sheltering and animal protection movements over the last decade have really done a huge shift to be a resource for the community and to provide owner support services. And Humane Society of the United States, we do free spay, neuter, and vaccines and other kinds of clinics in major cities around the country where there essentially are deserts for animal supplies or veterinary care. And the individual humane societies around the country are also, over the last 10 years, there's been a huge increase in the availability of low-cost or free medical care, spay-neuter, and to get rid of that that judgment in many of these cases so that people can feel as comfortable as possible in reaching out for help.
Well, Denise, I really appreciate your call. Let's go to Tamworth, where Nancy's on the line. Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
What's called an EMDR therapist, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's one of the two evidence-based forms of psychotherapy acknowledged by the World Health Organization for trauma. So one of my concerns is the people who go in and do the rescues. In EMDR, we have what's called a single incident protocol. So if these people want to see an EMDR therapist, they could come in and see someone who can do a single incident protocol and just deal with that trauma.
So,
oftentimes that can be done within a very reasonable amount of time. My other concern is what I think Lindsay was just talking about, or the other person, are people who are hoarders and have that mental illness. There is a lot of judgment and shame, and there is very specific protocol for treatment for hoarders, not the people who breed and sell with intent. That's different. The thing with hoarders is, I think those of us who care deeply about animals, we can sometimes be quick to judge.
We talked earlier, Nancy. I really appreciate you chiming in on that, because we did discuss earlier how, you know, it's easy to judge, but there are clearly, in many of these instances, some mental health issues for the person involved. So thank you, Nancy, for the call. Couple questions here from listeners by email that I'll share with you after a break. But the basic message from several listeners is, what can we do to improve this situation? So we'll talk about that after a short break. And you can join us as well at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're following up on the latest incidents of animal abuse, hoarding, and neglect in New Hampshire. We're looking at how and why these extreme situations develop. And let's get your questions and comments in 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, at NHPR Exchange. And Lindsay Hamrick, Lisa Dennison, Sarah Proctor, let's go back to our listeners. And here's an email from Logan in Exeter who says, how can regular citizens best help protect other animals from these horrific conditions and their horrible owners? Logan says, is there model legislation we can push our legislature to get passed? Is it volunteering? Who should we volunteer with? Is it donating? Who should we donate to? And then an email from Brian along a similar line. Brian says, what will it take to change the laws in New Hampshire to ensure this sort of cruelty doesn't happen again? Logan and Brian, thank you for the emails. Really important questions. And I want to ask everybody, but Lisa, I'll start with you.
Well, you know, there are legislation that we're constantly working on every year. The New Hampshire Federation of Humane Organizations, which is a collection of all the brick-and-mortar shelters as well as some others and HSUS, that we work each year to enact particular pieces of legislation, and we encourage people to actively get involved and to work with their local representatives and such to enforce it. Lindsay perhaps can speak to what we're looking at this year or have done most recently.
Go ahead, Lindsay.
Sure. So on the policy end of things, there's a whole lot that we can do. And I spoke already about the changes to commercial breeder regulations, which we will absolutely be pushing in the next year. But
lowering the amount of puppies or kittens.
Correct. And ensuring that there are the resources and the ability to enforce the regulations. And then secondary to that, I think, you know, for our listeners, the current law, our current animal cruelty law, separates the misdemeanor level cruelty in terms of negligence. The felony level animal cruelty provision is very specific, and you need to prove that somebody purposely mutilated, tortured, beat, or whipped an animal in order to reach that felony level bar. And there are states that are pushing for felony level provisions in extreme neglect situations.
So these hoarding situations right now don't fall under the felony
typically
provisions.
No, correct. It depends on the evidence, but for the most part, most of those are misdemeanor charges. And I think that in order for us to change those laws, it has to be a groundswell of grassroots support. And so in my work here in New Hampshire, we put on grassroots meetings every fall around the state to try to encourage citizens to get engaged in the political process, because your legislators have to hear from you on these issues in order for this to raise to the level of change. Because sadly, there are many who work against these provisions. Folks tend to be surprised that we don't already have certain laws on the books, but there are groups who don't want to see these changes. And so we need the citizens to get involved in that. And the last piece that I'll mention, which Lisa touched on, is that until we address the cost to take care of animals from these cases, we are working against what we're trying to do. And currently, because the town in which the cruelty occurs is responsible and thereby their taxpayers, it is such a unrealistic burden on them. We have pushed in the past and we will continue to advocate for what's called the cost of animal care law, which would require the defendant in these cases to cover the cost of care. And those decisions are made by a judge based on the evidence. The judge makes the determination about how much the cost should be. So this is a process that needs to be put in place. We want to find a balance between defendants' rights and the ability to cover these costs. And the model language that we use does both of those.
Well, and it sounds like, though, from what all of you have said, going after the defendant financially is maybe squeezing blood from a stone. I mean, the whole reason that they're hoarding partly is they got in over their heads and don't know what to do about it.
Correct. And some cost
of animal. So is there any money there, really?
Right. And in situations where there are resources, it would be nice to have a system where that could be recouped. In the situations where there aren't, some of the cost of animal care laws or even civil forfeiture laws in other states actually require the surrender of those animals if they can't be cared for.
Go ahead, Sarah.
I think there's two things that I think an individual, a private citizen can do to help. As far as donations go, I've read a lot of the social media comments about the Wolfboro case, and I see people questioning what HSUS is doing with their money and saying don't donate to HSUS. But I can now speak from personal experience that Wolfboro could not have done this without HSUS.
Again, that's Humane Society of the U.S.
Right, yeah. Humane Society of the U.S. And they do a lot of other things, but their animal operation in Wolfboro was amazing. There were 80 people on site at one point, and they were professionals in every sense of the word. I've never seen people handle animals in such compassionate way, in such a trying situation. So I think donating to the Humane Society of the U.S. or donating to a local shelter that does cruelty investigation is a great way to spend your money. Not every shelter slash rescue is involved in that kind of operation, so it's probably important to call the place you're interested in donating to and saying, what do you do? I think the other thing that an individual can do is do some homework before they obtain a puppy or a kitten or a dog or a cat or a rat.
Make sure it's not a terrible puppy mill or
right.
kitten mill or whatever.
If you came to my shelter in Dover, the staff would be more than willing to show you where the dogs live. And talk all about what we do for the animals and where they came from. And I think a good breeder should be willing to do the same.
If you buy off the internet, you don't really have that ability right. to look at it with your own eyes.
Right. And that, I think, was a big issue with the Wolfboro case, that it looked like a lot of the sell of puppies was done over the internet.
Because who would have bought from such a terrible situation.
Right. And the website was very well done and it looked great. And there are people that will buy dogs from the internet from a breeder. They'll buy, not buy, but they'll rescue dogs from another part of the country by just looking at a picture online and never having met the dog and not knowing what the conditions were or the care that the dog received. And it's not like buying clothes over the internet where you can just send them back if they don't fit. The dog right. gets shipped across the country and it has a health problem or it doesn't have the temperament you want. And are you going to send it back? Probably not, because you are attached to it and you feel bad.
Or it's difficult.
Right. Or they won't take it back. I think yeah. that's another good thing, that a good breeder should be willing to take a dog back if you aren't happy with it for some reason.
Lisa?
Yes, I just wanted to jump in on that, too, because we see thousands of dogs in New Hampshire that are purchased across the internet, and many people who are rescuing animals, they believe that they are rescuing animals, and sometimes they are, but the challenge is that they're arriving, they're bypassing some of the laws in the state, such as quarantine, because they're purchased before they arrive, and so they can bypass those laws, come into the state. The animal may or may not be exactly what they thought it was, whether by temperament or health, as Sarah said. And then the truck has left the parking lot. And so you turn around and there's nobody who's going to take that animal back but your local shelter. And of course, I'm the director of a humane society of a local shelter in the state, so I'm going to advocate for us and just say that there are laws to protect you. There are lemon laws. If you adopt an animal and it needs to be returned within 2 weeks for health or temperament, you can do that. So it's really important to know where you're getting, whether you're purchasing or adopting an animal, and to know what your protections are as well.
Well, great questions from Logan and Brian. Thank you for those. And let's go back to our callers. And Emily is in Pembroke. Hi, Emily. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. I just like what you guys were just saying. I've been breeding for almost 40 years, and I just want people to know that breeders do care. You know, we do all the health checks on our dogs. We start from the very first breath they take. Where our hands are on them. We socialize them. We sit with them at night. We cry over them. And when they're 10 years old and some idiot gets a new job, I take them back.
Wow. Okay.
And there's lots of us out there like that.
You're a dog breeder, Emily?
Yes.
Yeah.
I breed German Shepherds, and I've been doing it for almost 40 years.
Wow.
A long time.
So what are your thoughts? I'm so glad you called, Emily. What are your thoughts on what we talked about earlier, that some states have laws that say breeders really should only be selling 10 puppies a year? In New Hampshire, it's up to 50, or not so much should, but you're qualified as a breeder if you are selling up to 10 puppies or up to 50 puppies.
Some of the problems with it are somebody should be inspecting people, but what kind of inspection should they be? I mean, you want puppies that are raised within your house and your home, definitely not like what Wolfboro was, but I mean, puppies that are raised in the house. And that means it can't be a cement run everywhere. It's part of your family, part of your house. And a lot of the things in the inspections to some of these commercial things are they want, you know, stainless steel dishes, chain, you know, not even chain link fence. They want fences that are the perfect thing and, you know, cement runs. Well, how do you do that in your living room?
Yeah. So, Emily, are you pretty happy?
Are
you pretty happy with the way the rules and regs are now, or do you think they should be changed?
I think there should be inspections.
I
have no problems with people inspecting, and I think they should be done for group licenses. I mean, just because you have five dogs doesn't mean, you know, somebody shouldn't stop by every so often and say, yeah, you got five dogs. They look good.
Okay. Emily, really good to hear from you. Yeah. Go ahead, Lindsay.
I think I very much appreciate her comments, and we certainly make a distinction between responsible breeders who follow everything she's just discussed versus what we saw in Wolfboro. Unfortunately, just last week, through the state budget proposal, there has been a shift. So the law previously was that every animal licensee in the state was inspected on an annual basis on an unannounced schedule. The new provision, which went through with the budget, essentially makes inspections voluntary and complaint-based. And so we don't yet know what that means or what the frequency of inspections will be. And that change applies to commercial breeders, pet stores, and the shelters and rescues in the state. And we would certainly advocate that we go back to the system that we were at originally.
Again, the system we were at originally was that required annual inspection. Now it's will show up at some point?
It seems, I mean, to be honest, the language that was passed was quite vague. And so we're not quite clear how that will be interpreted yet.
Well, I wonder with all the attention given these cases, Lindsay, that there'll be a little more light shown on that. We got some comments on Facebook from Andy Shigori. He is the chief of police in Tufton Borough. He cares a lot about this issue. He served on the Governor's Commission on the Humane Treatment of Animals. So I want to share a couple of Chief Shigori's thoughts. First of all, he says a central state agency would eliminate the issue of the cost to towns. Chief Shigori says it's not likely that a town can plan for how many cases they will handle a year. It may be quite a few years between cases. Statewide, there will be several a year. Now, Lisa, this is something you talked about earlier, and I am struck by the fact that towns have to pick up these costs because it's a lot.
It can be a lot. And unfortunately, when the town doesn't pay their bills, it falls on the shelters, and therefore it all actually rolls back to the citizens of the state who are supporting the humane societies.
I wonder what's the thinking behind putting it on the town. Is it that they should have paid more attention? They should have noticed the funny things that were going on? I'm just wondering why the town is held liable. Go ahead, Sarah.
I think it's the difference in New Hampshire, and I think a lot of New England, is the way our animal control structure is that in other parts of the country, there are municipal shelters run by the city or run by the town that have a budget to do everything that the NHSPCA does.
And I see. They're not private nonprofits.
Right.
They're city or town agencies.
Right. With staff. And I think in New Hampshire and a lot of New England, that has all been privatized and the towns don't have maybe, I don't know if we could say don't need, but they don't have the resources and they have relied heavily on the private shelter community.
That's interesting. So the old image, you know, of like the city dog catcher, take them to the city pound, those are the instances where it's a public institution.
Right.
With public funding. Yeah, go
ahead.
That's
correct. So at the New Hampshire SPCA, for example, we impound for 21 towns. So if an animal control officer in the city of Portsmouth has a stray dog, it will come to us. Now, the citizen is required to pay for that if they reclaim it. But if after 7 days nobody's come and found that animal, that becomes our property, but we also bear the burden of that. We'll then turn around and charge the town for it. But none of the shelters receive any state or city money for this kind of work. We do municipal work.
Well, Chief Shigori also says the Connecticut Department of Agriculture has enforcement authority statewide for investigating these cases, and that Connecticut has something called Desmond's Law, where abused animals get a volunteer advocate in court cases. Wow. Okay. Thank you, Chief Shigori, for those comments. A couple other comments here that I would love to share with you. Elisa says, being someone who takes care of animals while they're waiting for these cases to be processed is really frustrating. It's hard to separate from the fact that this person might be struggling mentally with the condition of the animals and offer up any sympathy for the caregiver. But Elisa says it is a real issue that needs to be addressed. So that gets back to the mental health sometimes of the people accused of hoarding. And then here's an email from Laura in Bartlett who says animals have been relegated to property, objects, commodities. Throughout history, and laws governing their treatment always reflect what is best for human commerce, desire, and a moral duplicity that has shaped human society. This is really interesting, Lisa, and you mentioned that your organization, SPCA, has been around for more than 100 years. I wonder about this evolution of how we regard animals and their rights.
They are absolutely viewed as property, and certain animals have more rights than others. So, for example, dogs have more protection than cats. Dogs are licensed. Cats are not. It's just one example. When we look at even stray animals, those that are returned to owner, those that are picked up by animal control and brought in for protection, cats generally are not. And that's not even to speak to all the other species that we care for, both large and small.
Well, and we got an email from someone concerned about seeing some rabbits that he thought were mistreated. And I know I've been at the Concord SPCA, and there are times when they have a lot.
We just had a case, 27 rabbits and 16 guinea pigs and 5 dogs and 3 horses.
Last question,
weeks ago.
And Lindsay, I'll turn to you on this. I think, you know, given the high-profile attention on these cases, again, the cats in Barnstead earlier this year, the terrible situation with the dogs in Wolfboro, the horses that we saw in Deering recently, what do you think? Do you expect an increase in anonymous tips from the public about other suspected animal abuse?
I mean, we certainly hope that one of the positive impacts of these cases is it raises awareness. And the Humane Society of the United States, we have a tip line both for animal fighting and for suspected puppy mills. And the puppy mill tip line is 1-877-MILL-TIP. That's MILLTIP. And all of your local humane societies will also take in your concerns as well.
Well, and we'll put that information up on our website along with other resources. Thank you all so much for being here. Lindsay, it was really nice to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Lindsay Hamrick, State Director of the Humane Society of the U.S. Sarah Proctor, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Sarah Proctor, Director of the Veterinary Technology Program at UNH and an Assistant Professor at the Thompson School of Applied Science. And Lisa Dennison, it was good to meet you too. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Dennison, Executive Director of the New Hampshire SPCA. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.